So, what's trending? Bridging your Catholic faith with your everyday life. You're listening to Trending with Timory on Relevant Radio.
Welcome, welcome. I hope everyone had an incredible 4th of July. I know it was great and quite a surprise not being in California, where we are fire season all the time, all year round. It was great to see the number of fireworks that occurred. And I was with a friend and we were looking out, and I mean, we watched it long into the night. And the fireworks kept going and going. At one point, we had this really great view over the city, and I counted over 130 different firework displays going at once, and they went on for hours. And I thought, okay, is this a COVID response, or is this just what it's like to not be in California for fireworks? Because it was incredible. And there was this moment where I was like, we needed this. We needed to see people were happy to live in the United States of America. Not only were people happy to live in the United States of America, but they were happy and excited to be free. To be outside of our homes, to be doing things. And for this overstepping of the government that has occurred, for example, in places such as California and others with regard to freedom of worship, everything we've been through over the last year and a half, it was one of those moments where we go, praise God for this great nation he has given us. And it's a reminder for all of us to be involved in our civic duty and patriotism. And especially to emphasize the importance of freedom in our own lives and that pursuit of happiness that is so important. I was listening to a couple of people over the weekend who have come out with this newfound identity. And it really made me ponder, does living in your own reality make you happiest? You know, we have this, you know, 21st century American mindset that freedom means I can be anything or anyone I want to be. But can you really? Can you really? And is making yourself a new you really the best thing you can do? You're listening to Trending with Timory here on Relevant Radio. Coming up, joining me will be a specialist and addiction therapist and addictive disorder, Sister Tina Alfieri. She's also a hermit, a nun, and an incredibly talented spiritual director. And so she'll be joining us. If you have a question during the show, the number is 1-888-914-9149. I'll also be giving you a rundown on the big deal with regard to regulations surrounding the abortion pill. You might say, well, this really doesn't affect me. It's not a big deal. It is. This is going to be the largest. This is the largest expansion of abortion that we've seen in our nation. And there's something that you can actually do about it. But let's come to this whole idea of a new you. You know, we missed our happy hour, at least for the live show, because we all had the holiday. Many of us had the holiday yesterday. So we missed our happiest topic. And I just couldn't get away from it because I kept thinking about this coming into the week. How so many people will say, new you, you'll be happy, you know, you can remake yourself into anything and now anyone you want. But does living in your own reality actually make you happier or happiest? Demi Lovato, over the last month, has gone from no longer just being pansexual to now non-binary. And she's let everyone know that she's chosen her pronouns are now they and them. I'm also going to tell you about a shocking other story about a trans Korean, or a trans Asian, as some people are saying. Now, this is relevant to all of us when it comes to freedom and happiness. But first, listen to what Demi Lovato said about her newfound identity.
But for me, it means having conversations that transcend the typical discourse. I want to take this moment to share something very personal with you. Over the past year and a half, I've been doing some healing and self-reflective work. And through this work, I've had the revelation that I identify as non-binary. With that said, I'll officially be changing my pronouns to they, them.
I'll be officially changing my pronouns to they, them. Please don't forget to refer to me as they, them, even though we have a whole English language that we drill into you for years of education, teaching you how to speak and how to address people. Just ignore all of that. You can make yourself anything you want to be. But here's the deal. It's not just Demi Lovato. There's another influencer who's influencing many people today. And he's known, sorry, just be clear, he's a white Instagram star influencer. He's British, known as Ollie London. Now, he, for some time now, has wanted to be just like a BTS singer. BTS singer has been his idol, and so he's been trying to transform his identity into that. He spent, I believe, over like $150,000 just trying to transform his identity into this influencer who influenced him. Now, then, should I say, he's decided he wants to be Korean, and he's had eye surgery. 18 surgeries later. And this is his response after the latest surgery.
Hey guys, I'm finally Korean. I've transitioned. I'm so happy. I've completed my look. I'm finally Korean, guys. I have the eyes. Just had a brow lift as well. So I'm so happy. Finally, I've been trapped in the wrong body for 8 years. And that's the worst feeling in the world when you're trapped and you don't feel like you can be yourself. But finally, I'm Korean. I can be myself. And I'm so happy.
And since
he's so happy because he has had eye surgery. And now he can identify as trans Korean, trans Asian, whatever he wants to refer to himself as. Now, he also refers to himself as non-binary. And you should be sure to make sure that you call him they as well. You see, all of this is relevant when we talk about freedom and we talk about happiness. Why? Because we live in a world that loves to say that I can be whatever I want to be. And this is relevant in particular for recent college graduates, high school graduates, where the world's actually lying to them. Very unfairly, saying you can be and do whatever you want. Well, actually, you can't be or do anything you want. Because the reality is that the human person has limitations. Even as we're reconstructing our bodies with phenomenal plastic surgery, even as we can make a man look really pretty, and I'll be honest, there was like a Miss Universe or someone. It was a man who was actually a woman. Patrick, pull that up. I'm curious who it was. I can't remember. I had to like just go, okay, I'm moving on. This man who identifies as a woman and who has had surgeries and cross-sex hormones to look like a woman, he looks gorgeous. I understand why he won beauty contest. But should he be competing in a beauty contest against other women? Should that even be considered fair given the level of plastic surgery that he's commissioned? You see, here's the problem. Not only does this lie to people saying you can become whatever you want to become, but it also puts us in a sense of a false reality. Does living in your own reality make you happiest? No, it doesn't. Because at a certain point, your reality is going to clash with reality. Your reality is going to clash with family, friends, neighbors, with the doctor's office. The transgender woman crowned Miss Intercontinental New Zealand in 2020. That's who it was. You see, reality matters. Truth matters. And actually, when we live according to what is true, that's when we're happiest. When we live acknowledging that I have two legs and I don't have one leg, we'll be happier. We can't just live in our own reality, because I could say for years I only have one leg, to the point where some people will literally say they only have one leg and they'll want to amputate the other leg. They want to walk on crutches or be pushed around in a wheelchair. That impacts the individual. It impacts others who come into contact with that individual. You see, moral relativism is eating us alive. Moral relativism that says you can become anything you want. You can't. And that there's a lot of joy when we recognize this, actually. When we recognize there are not just limitations, but there's a purpose to who we are and what we're created to be. You see, a purpose not just written into the body, but written into the heart, the soul, the mind, for how we're meant to live and act and interact with the world. You see, you are created as an absolute act of love. And you are created for love. And you are created by love himself. No, if you were created, that means that you have a purpose. And that purpose is to image, be in the image and likeness of God. God gave us freedom. But here's the reality. He didn't give us freedom so that we could do wrong. He didn't give us freedom so that we could choose to reject the natural order of creation. He gave us freedom so that we could freely love. You see, God created us in His image and likeness. He is love. And if we want to participate in that love, if we are truly made in His image and likeness, we couldn't just be made to be forced to do everything that He wants. We couldn't be forced to follow every commandment He has, because we would be considered slaves. Not people who He created out of an act of love and who He created for love. You see, this is where we have to understand. Freedom has a positive definition. Freedom is for something, not for something. Freedom is for the purpose of your choosing good. Freedom is for the purpose of this young man, a social media influencer, Ole London. It's for him to understand and be at peace with the man God created him to be. And not to feel like he constantly has to change his body and chase plastic surgery to feel happy. You know, I was looking at his Instagram and he has tons of followers. But not only does he have tons of followers, he has a ton of attention for all of the things he's doing to mutilate and transform his body. Articles everywhere are commenting on this young boy who's gone through with having surgery to change his eyes so that he can identify and look like the BTS singer, a pop sensation that he loves and admires. See, young people today feel like they can't even post a photo of themselves, because they think there has to be a filter. But that filter isn't the filter that Instagram offers. That filter is the self-criticism and self-judgment and really slavery that they have subscribed to in a world of moral relativism, where they think that they can live in their own reality and be defined by their own reality. And that is what will make them happy. What they're discovering, just like this new trans Asian individual, to what point does it go? How far? He already went through $150,000 worth of plastic reconstructive surgery to try and look like a singer that he loves. And then he went through more to have his eyes changed. To what end? We have to stop allowing the lie of moral relativism, the wrong view of freedom, and the incorrect understanding of happiness to reign. Freedom is for the sake of good. Happiness is rooted in God and what God created us for, to be in His image and likeness and to be with Him in heaven, which means our bodies and our souls have a purpose, have a proper function. You're listening to Trending with Tim Ray here on Relevant Radio. Joining me now on Trending is Sister Tina Alfieri. Sister Tina is a specialist, a therapist, as a certified sexual addiction therapist, a recovery coach for addictive disorders. She is a hermited nun and a spiritual director. We're taking your questions on everything from marriage repair after infidelity, spiritual direction, or even 12-step recovery from addictive disorders. Give us a call. This hour is for you. The number is 1-888-914-9149. You can also comment on social media, on my post that's up on Twitter, or my Instagram story. We put a question box up. I'd love to hear from you. Sister Tina, you do a lot of work with women and men, especially women who are recovering from the betrayal that occurs from pornography in particular, but also can be linked to marital infidelity as well. I'd like to define and really discuss how you can be happy after experiencing infidelity and how you can really repair that marriage. What are some of the first steps after the infidelity to recover?
Hi, Tamarie. Thank you for having me today. I do appreciate being able to discuss this topic with you and with your listeners. Marriage repair after infidelity. I'm going to be very frank. It's not an easy row to hoe. It's not easy. It is a very long process. And both spouses must be committed to the process. Many people have a misconception that only the person who was unfaithful is the one who needs to do the work. Now, in the beginning of marriage repair, that may be true. They've got to do what I call the heavy lifting. They've got to do the brunt of the work. But in about 3 or 4 months down the road, the wounded spouse, the one who was harmed by the infidelity, they have to start also doing their own work. And this is where a lot of spouses who are the wounded spouse or the harmed spouse get stuck. They don't see a need oftentimes for themselves to get any help or support. Now, and that's a legitimate concern and a legitimate fear, because oftentimes in the therapy world, or sometimes even in the spiritual world with clergy, it has been a very sad history that the harmed spouse was often blamed for the unfaithful spouse's behavior.
Right, very common.
Very common. And so there's a lot of concern still today with the wounded spouse saying, well, why do I need to go get help or talk to a professional? I didn't do anything wrong. My first response is, you are absolutely correct. You didn't. But now you need people on your side, people who can assist you and be supportive for you, be an ally for you, and be in your corner helping you to heal from this wound. And it's a very deep wound. It's a very difficult wound. We're talking about betrayal trauma, which is one of the most, if not the most, impactful, harmful, significant traumas a person in a committed relationship can experience. So it's not to fix the wounded partner, because we don't want to get into that old trap, that old wrong thinking of blaming someone, the wounded spouse, for the infidelity, because it's not their fault. They didn't cause it. And it's not up to them to do anything about changing the unfaithful spouse's behavior. But we do encourage the wounded spouse to get help and support for themselves, because this is going to be, if one decides to stay in the marriage, and again, that's really for each individual couple, each individual partner of the coupleship, they will be making their own decision if this is something that they wish to stay in. If they do want to stay in the marriage, I am very upfront in telling them, you each have to do the work, and this is not going to be fixed, or and it's not going to go away overnight, a year or 2 years, maybe even 3, 4, or 5 years. This is a very deep wound that is going to be constantly needing to be worked on for the rest of the marriage.
So that brings up another really important question. If you're just joining us, that's Sister Tina Alfieri. She's a certified sexual addiction therapist and a recovery coach for addictive disorders. And we often see after years passed from the infidelity that a person who has perhaps had their spouse cheat on them, there's a struggle where anxiety and sometimes even fear will arise with regard to how their other spouse interacts with others. How do you address that as time goes on?
So that's a very ongoing piece of work. We have to understand that when most people go into marriage, they are assuming, and rightly so, that their marriage partner is going to be faithful, that they're going to be supportive emotionally, financially, fiscally, financially, and that there will be only good intentions towards each other.
So always having a positive mindset and not assuming the worst, it sounds like.
Exactly right. And that's what marriage is about, is to help each other to grow in holiness. And then when there is an infidelity, it's a deep wound, because now the person who you have expected to always be there for you, have your best interest at heart, take care of you, take care of the children. They have harmed you. They have wounded you. They have proven to you to not be trustworthy. That's a very, very deep wound. And trust takes a very, very, very long time to earn back. And so that's why when I do work with couples where there has been infidelity in the marriage, I'm very frank with them and say, this is not going to be 30 days of therapy. It's not going to be maybe 30 months of therapy. It may be 4 or 5 years of therapy. And it takes work on both your parts. The wounded partner has to learn how to take care of themselves. The wounded partner has to understand what sets them off into a cycle of wondering what is the unfaithful partner doing. I'm just going to use he. Most of the infidelity is by men, not always, but the majority. So you may have a wife who's wondering, well, what is he doing? He says he's at work. Can I trust him? Is he at work or is he at the strip club down the street? Is he calling his affair partners? Has he reinitiated contact with them? So understanding the wounded partner, what triggers her and what those triggers are, and how she can help herself to understand these wounds and how to work on herself is a big part of what the betrayed partner has to do. Now, the unfaithful partner has a whole heck of a lot of work to do. As I said before at the beginning, that they do have the grunt work, the brunt, the heavy lifting of the repair, especially for about the first 6 months or so, the first 6 months or a year, that unfaithful partner has the majority of the work to do. And I'm very open and honest with couples that, look, if you don't want to be reminded every day of the affair, the harm that it's caused, the hurt that it's caused, then marriage repair is not for you. Because you're going to have to own up, you're going to have to take responsibility, you're going to have to really get down and dig and say, I was wrong. The unfaithful partner is going to be wrong for the rest of the marriage. I'm sorry, but that is how it is. You have done a huge breach of trust. And if you're not prepared to do the heavy work, the ongoing work, more than likely the lifelong work of earning your partner's trust back, then you're not ready to repair the marriage.
Now, Sister Tina Alfieri here on Trending. We're going to discuss a very important topic when it comes to infidelity. Why continue to honor the marital vow? And why is that so important after infidelity? You're listening to Trending with Tim Ray. We're taking your questions, everything from 12-step program, addiction, or marital infidelity with Sister Tina. Give us a call, 1-888-914-9149. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
We're talking about what you're thinking about. You're listening to Trending with Timory on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Joining me now here on Trending is Sister Tina Alfieri, a certified sexual addiction therapist, a recovery coach for addictive disorders, a spiritual director, and a hermited-inhabited nun. Sister Tina, we've been talking about overcoming the wound of infidelity in marriage from a distinctly Catholic perspective, and I think that this is a very, very important question. Why is it so important to honor the marital vow of fidelity after infidelity has occurred in marriage?
So we know that marriage repair is possible, and we know that having sinful behavior is not grounds for a divorce or a Catholic annulment. But sometimes the behavior, the infidelity, is harmful. And, well, it's always harmful, but so harmful that the marriage could possibly be beyond repair. So I'd like to talk maybe a bit, just briefly about some options some couples choose in the beginning, because in the beginning, when the infidelity or unfaithfulness has been discovered, many couples, it's very difficult emotionally to stay under the same household. Many feel that they need to separate. That's fine. Sometimes for safety reasons, that's best. Emotions are usually very high and all over the place upon the initial revelation or finding out about breaking the marriage vow. So sometimes separating, somebody goes to a hotel, either the husband or the wife, or goes to a friend's house or a family member's house for several days. But then there's also the possibility that if they just can no longer live together, they don't have to divorce. They can, it is an option to maintain separate households. Sometimes that's not the best option, but for some very conservative-minded Catholics, they don't want to divorce for any reason, but you can remain married, but you do not have to live under the same roof. Now, there's a concept also that we need to consider, and that's self-preservation and safety of any children, minors that are in the house. So let's kind of put this into perspective. Let's say that, what if this person was an alcoholic? And so let's say the husband is an alcoholic. He comes home. He is absolutely no husband to the wife, no parent to the children. In fact, he's emotionally harmful, psychologically harmful to the wife, to the children. He's not taking the earnings from his job and using them to support the family. He's using all of his earnings to drink. The family is having to depend on other family members for money or outside sources of help in order to just get by. The Catholic Church and God does not want us to be a doormat and does not want us to put ourselves in harm's way. I love scripture, and it says we need to be as wise as serpents, yet gentle as doves. If someone is harming us psychologically and emotionally and or physically and or sexually, we are not bound by a vow to stay through that.
To
we
be
are
in
not.
Physical contact with the
exactly.
person. I think that's an important distinction that a lot of people don't understand, that fidelity can be, and sometimes this is the best act of love, is physical separation, to have boundaries in terms of
Amen.
How you interact with other people. And so that boundary may be physical separation, but that doesn't mean that you're not still married in the eyes of the church, in the
Correct.
Eyes of God, and that you mm-hmm. can suddenly remarry and start dating. That's where fidelity enters in. You know, there are countless stories, and a great compilation of them is the book edited by Layla Miller, Impossible Marriages Redeemed, so-called impossible marriages, because there are marriages mm-hmm. that were on the brink of divorce where they were able, through the intensity of infidelity and multiple times of infidelity, to work things out in the long term with years and time. But it took fidelity to the vow, to the sacrament, that allowed that to occur with having boundaries as time went on.
Exactly. And it takes that unfaithful partner to really get gut level honest with themselves, with God, with their partner about the nature of what they've been doing, and for that unfaithful partner to accept that this is going to be a wound that may never be completely healed. It's going to be a triggering event and have lasting effects for the rest of the marriage. And you have to accept that, the you're never going to go back to the pre-infidelity marriage. It's not there anymore. Once that trust has been broken, it's never going to go back to the way it was. It can be repaired so that it's something different and livable and doable and workable and is a credit to both spouses and to the marriage vow. But I often see sometimes couples kind of linger and they want things to go back the way it was. That's
a big... never happened.
Exactly. And that's right. Just not going to be reality.
It's not possible.
Yeah. It's a very difficult work. Your world has changed.
That's Sister Tina Alfieri here on Trending. And this is the challenge, the incredible challenge of marital fidelity in the midst of infidelity. But the beauty of the church's teaching can be a healing balm in the midst of the most challenging of circumstances. And being challenged with the opportunity to show that unconditional love that Christ has given by remaining faithful, the fidelity to your spouse given and the example given to your children in the midst of that, and the great gift that is to the greater, I think, family unit as a whole, but also the individual as time goes on. Again, incredible story shared. If you find yourself or know someone in the circumstance, Impossible Marriages Redeemed, edited by Layla Miller. Sister Tina, your recovery coach and specialize in addictive disorders. We have a number of questions coming in. If you have a question, the number is 1-888-914-9149, or you can comment now on my Instagram story. We put up a question box. Question has to do with steps to get over the habit of self-abuse. What are some tips I can follow? This question comes from Instagram.
That's what it means, usually cutting or self-mutilating. So when they say self-abuse, I'm going to assume that we're talking about masturbation. So steps to take, we need to understand that there's a difference between a habit and an addiction. So with intensive effort, time, and intensity, we can overcome any bad habit, such as sleeping in late, constantly hitting that snooze button, eating sugary foods, not exercising. We can always overcome a bad habit. If something has progressed to the point to where it's an addiction, we're in a totally different realm. This is a medical problem. It's a psychological problem. And our efforts usually fail us. So the first thing I usually ask people is, how long have you been trying to work on this particular issue? 3 months, 6 months, 12 years, the past 30 years, a good general 12 months, 18 months, and you are doing you've taken every suggestion that you've ever heard. Maybe you have you go to confession every week. You have a spiritual director and you're working with your spiritual director. Maybe you have filters on the internet. Maybe you have these things, but this is still a losing situation. You're always coming out failing or falling. There's a very good chance we have passed from something just becoming a habit to it's a problem, a medical problem, mental health problem, and you need to seek professional help. So the first thing is get into a regular sacramental life. Follow the precepts of the church. Attending Mass regularly, holy days of obligation, confession regularly. Have a spiritual director that you meet with on a consistent basis, a minimum 1 hour once a month. Consistency is key. And then put all of the suggestions to work, such as pornography blocking software, praying the Divine Mercy Chaplet, praying the Chaplet of St. Michael the Archangel. Do all of that. But if in 12 months, 18 months, you're still in the same place and still fighting the same battle, Now we're looking at probably needing to get into some more structured help, such as a 12-step self-help group, such as Sexaholics Anonymous, or going to see a therapist who specializes in you can start to get out of this this kind of like really, really deep spiral that just only goes downward.
So it sounds like it's very important at this point. You know, you have the filtration software, you have accountability, you have a spiritual director, you know, you have things that you're working on, but at this point it crosses over, as you're mentioning, into an addiction, into a concern of mental health. So having that therapist, having ongoing therapy to work through this addiction is extremely important. I think that that's an important thing to understand. You know, the question came through, what are some tips? We can't look at it in a blasé fashion. Mm-hmm. That's the challenge. Mm-hmm. And I think that this is where sometimes people have some form of an addiction and we downplay that addiction we're experiencing. Well, often we downplay it for so long, we don't even start downplaying it until it's already become past a habit, it's become a real problem. So I think exactly. These are great tips. I want to change directions. We have another question that came in on Instagram from Brittany, and it has to do with how to help discern between recreational versus medicinal use of marijuana, pharmaceutical marijuana, and really understanding, and like she's an up-and-coming therapist. So her comment is, you know, the church isn't always clear in helping her to understand this from a clinical mm-hmm. perspective. And so mm-hmm. how can we address and combat the relaxed view on marijuana and marijuana addiction?
Okay, fantastic question. So I just use the same standard or measuring stick for other drugs that are already out there and legal, namely alcohol. How do we know when alcohol becomes problematic for someone? It's a legal liquid drug for people usually ages 18 and over. Some states it might be 21 and over, but it's a legal liquid drug that is easily obtainable and is many adults partake in it. So how do we know when alcohol becomes problematic? Well, it begins to interfere with relationships, family, work, school, business opportunities, our sacramental relationship, maybe that Holy Spirit nudges us and is like, wow, you know, you really tied one on last night, or you smoked too much weed yesterday. That I don't think that goes over very well with God. So the same things that we look at to determine if anything has segued or transitioned into an addiction is you're using more or spending more time in the use or participation of this drug activity or behavior. Family, friends, significant others are complaining and saying, hey, I don't like how much you're doing this or how often you're doing this. You may be missing out on important events, special events. You may be misusing your own finances, money that you had set aside to pay for gas in the car this week goes to buy a quantity of marijuana or alcohol instead. So just because something is legal still doesn't make it non-addicting. So that's, you know, I don't have a dog in this fight when people ask me, should marijuana be legalized? I really don't care if it's legalized or not. The dog in the fight is, what are you going to do when people become addicted? Just like we've got people addicted to prescription medications, which are legally prescribed, alcohol, which is legally obtainable in almost any store in the United States. It's not the substance is the problem. Some people can use substances and it's not harmful. They don't cross over into addictive behavior. Other people, they cross over and they transition into it's now an addiction.
This is, I think, a great summary for people to really find the balance here, because there's a lot of debate over legal versus non-legal marijuana. And especially, I think, for the question coming from Brittany, from a clinical perspective, how important it is to understand that when any substance or even non-substance, such as pornography, mm-hmm. for example, begins to disrupt behavior, you just gave a bunch of incredible warning signs, from complaints from family, friends, coworkers, bosses, lack of proper performance in terms of work and home environment, mm-hmm. depression, lack of interest in things, when it impacts finances, all of these, or even shifty behavior, all of this begins to show when an addiction has set in. And I think this is important to be helpful, especially for parents as well, to watch out for in their children, as well mm-hmm. as to address it from the perspective of loved ones in terms of spouses, because marijuana continues to be a new and ever greater challenge with so-called legalization from state mm-hmm. to state here in the United mm-hmm. States. Sister Tina, thank you so much for joining us. Your candor and wisdom is always greatly appreciated to help people in addressing addiction in their own lives and overcome it and find joy, peace, hope, and healing in our Lord. Coming up, we're going to be addressing the topic of the abortion pill, the massive expansion we've seen taking place during COVID, and what you can and should do to help save lives and prevent this ongoing exposure and access to abortion in our nation. We'll be right back. Don't go away. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Bridging your Catholic faith with your everyday life. You're listening to Trending with Timory on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
You may have heard a lot recently about the abortion pill in the news. Some people talking about how there's going to be an increase in access to the abortion pill and how this is a good thing, because access to abortion helps women achieve what they want in life. You're going to hear another perspective as well, where people are saying, well, some people are trying to use harmful abortion pill reversal programs to prevent women from having abortions after they decided they wanted to. There's a lot of headlines that have been circling over the last couple of months surrounding the abortion pill and the abortion pill reversal. If you're not familiar with the abortion pill, it's commonly meant to be used only up until really the first about 8 weeks of a woman's pregnancy. It's a RU-46 mifepristone abortion pill, known as a non-surgical abortion, a medical abortion, a chemical abortion. It's a series of two sets of pills that a woman takes. Now, up until April of 2021, a woman had to go into a medical office and be prescribed this by a medical professional. Under the umbrella of COVID, President Joe Biden has now used COVID, for some odd reason, over a year into COVID, as supposedly COVID's getting better, suddenly uses COVID to use an emergency reason to deregulate the abortion pill, having to do with the regulation of how and when the abortion pill is given. Essentially, what this deregulation has done is it allows for what we could refer to as an Amazon packaged abortion, chemical abortion. How is that? Because people under this new rule as of April now can access a chemical abortion by being shipped to their home. First set of pills and second set of pills are taken at home. Now, in the facility, normally you only have to take the first set of chemical abortion pills, which basically start to suppress the proper function of progesterone, which supports a pregnancy. So it shuts down the ability and capacity for progesterone, an important chemical and hormone during pregnancy, to allow that baby to continue to grow. Then the second set of pills helps the baby essentially to be delivered. Now, what happens is this is an early delivery at home of the baby. The abortion providers, such as Planned Parenthood, look at the woman and tell her, flesh don't look when it comes time. Why? Because a woman is often able to see her child, if she's paying attention or aware, as the child is passed with time after having taken the RU46 chemical abortions. Now, this is really scary in the United States because this is what we are seeing, the largest expansion of abortion that we may see in our lifetime, and we need to speak up and fight against it. If you're wondering what you can do, a great resource can be found along with short form videos that you can share on social media. Perhaps you're a teacher, you can share with students to help them understand chemical abortion and understand why women deserve better. You can find information at thisischemicalabortion.com. Now, here's the reality today. About 40% of all abortions performed in the United States are RU46 chemical abortions. Now, there's a big question surrounding safety of chemical abortions, but here's the deal. We don't have a proper amount of information with regard to the things, that is, the complications that occur after a chemical abortion is started. You see, only 28 states have reported complications surrounding abortion. 22 states do not. They're not legally required to. Now, these 22 states are the states that have and perform most of the abortions. They make up well over 50% of all abortions that occur. You see, what's happening is we can't compare, for example, maternal mortality rates and complication numbers with under and unreported maternal mortality rates and chemical abortion numbers and complications when there isn't data there. You see, the only bit of data we have on chemical abortions comes out of Finland and England. For example, England has actually already gone through with deregulating the abortion pill and making it so-called more accessible. What they saw was more than a 2-time jump in the number of women who were having to go to the hospital and be hospitalized due to RU46 chemical abortion. That's doubled the number. Now, we know in the United States, many women have shared this. I've worked firsthand with women who have gone through with a, as you might call, do-it-yourself-at-home abortion, the chemical abortion. And many have shared how, as they've gone through with immense bleeding and blood clotting, how they were embarrassed to call 911, embarrassed to tell anyone, and they sit in their own misery in harmful and dangerous medical circumstances because they feel like they deserve it because they chose an abortion. And so these numbers we have, even coming from England, barely even scratch the surface of women who truly do need medical attention. Some of the problems with deregulating the RU46 abortion pill in the United States is that it's actually very important that a woman is receiving an ultrasound and proper medical care before ever either receiving a surgical or a chemical abortion. Why? Well, because she could be misdiagnosed in an ectopic pregnancy never caught, which could be detrimental for her and the child if an RU46 abortion occurs. Many women have adverse effects surrounding hemorrhaging and excessive bleeding, infection, and even a number of deaths that have occurred from RU46 abortion, but the statistics and the reporting is not accurate. States aren't required to list the death of a woman due to a chemical abortion. Instead, they put something such as hemorrhaging or infection. And so the statistics are incredibly skewed. However, in Finland, they have done some small cases of research. It's the only comparable research we have on RU46 abortions, which we've completely deregulated under the current administration of President Joe Biden in the name of COVID. Is, again, doesn't make sense why a year into COVID they'd use that to deregulate the pill, but they're using it for that. You see, Finland is showing that all of the research that they have, that basically when the abortion pill is taken under 9 weeks, 20% of those women who take the pill, the abortion pill, end up having complications. That's 1 in 5 women who take RU46 abortion pill in Finland. They're seeing 1 in 5 have complications after. You see, it also shows that chemical abortion, the pill abortion, is 4 times riskier than a surgical abortion. So a lot of people try to say that it's not that big of a deal. It's okay. It's just a couple of pills that occurs early on in the pregnancy. In fact, when we do look at a little bit of the data, it's more harmful for women. Why are we talking about this right now? Because state to state, we're going to see a huge battle over the expansion of abortion and ongoing abortion access. RU46 abortion is not safe for women. It's leading to incredible complications and lost motherhood. But here's the great news. You can do something by going to thisischemicalabortion.com. From sharing data and information to getting involved, contacting your legislators. But also, here's a beautiful thing. I've had the honor of working with Dr. George Delgado, who pioneered what's referred to as abortion pill reversal. That is after a woman takes the first set of chemical RU46 abortion pills and she changes her mind, it is possible to reverse that abortion. Here's the reality. 7 out of 10 babies have been saved when they turn to abortion pill reversal. And just over the last handful of years, women who have changed their minds after starting the abortion process, over 2,000 of their babies have been saved. Abortion pill reversal is changing and saving lives for women who thought they had no choice, changed their mind after making a terrible mistake, and now hold their babies and love them